Welcome to Access Utah. Researchers at the University of Utah in Salt Lake have identified a key protein role in the metastasis of melanoma, the most serious form of skin cancer. Today on the program, Dr. Ellie Grossman, lead author in this study published in the online journal, Science Signaling, joins us to talk about the finding that offers hope in stopping melanoma from spreading. At 9:30, Science Questions profiles the hydraulic fracking boom in two areas of the country, the Uinta Basin of Utah and southeastern Ohio, from the perspective of two farmers who are directly impacted by the extraction of natural gas near their farms. This will be coming up after the news. Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Mountain West Bank, a community bank offering a variety of services and summer loan options for consumers. At 110 South in Brigham City, information is at mountainwestbank.com. It's a division of Glacier Bank.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have a couple of minutes before we take you to Sherry Quinn with a science topic on Access Utah. Later on, Science Questions, of course. Yesterday, you'll recall, we had a discussion about your pet. Many of you responded with the pet questions for our pet trainer and just telling us about your pet, which is what we wanted. And we asked you to post a picture of your favorite pet on our Facebook page. Many of you did. By the way, we're still encouraging you to do so. We'd love to have a picture of your pet there. And we promised we'd get your brief message on the air. We ran out of time yesterday, so here are a few more messages about your pets. This one is from Gina Wickwar, who does commentaries for us, of course. She responded to our Nora Zambrino. We put out the word to friends and family, as it were, of UPR about their pets. She was disappointed she wasn't able to respond directly. She says, I'm sitting in a rental car place in San Francisco Airport, so I can't provide you with fascinating information about truly two of the most wonderfully clever, handsome golden doodles in the world. They're so talented that they have each teamed to jump on our bed and sleep with us. And also, they're so clever they can eat off a fork. And finally, this is something truly unique. They adore rolling in dead fish at Tony Grove Lake. I don't think you'll have any other pet owner who can match the exploits of Bear or Peach Wickwar. I just thought I would let you know that UPR audience will truly be missing first-rate discussion about our dogs. With tongue in cheek, I am Gina. That's Gina Wickwar. Thank you, Gina. And it ends up that UPR audience was able to hear the exploits. This one comes from Danielle Manley, who is interning at UPR. She posted this on the UPR page. A beautiful brown dog. This is Jackson. We call him Jack, and he has the biggest personality I've ever seen in a dog. He's extremely smart. I swear he knows exactly what I'm telling him. He can be spiteful and stubborn, as most bloodhounds are. He also has a very bad case of separation anxiety. He cries and bays when we leave, when we come home, and when he comes home. But we love him anyway. Other than a small dose of puppy Prozac, which our vet has given us, what would you suggest for this anxiety problem? We don't have Mark Ellis, our pet trainer, here with us, but luckily, Paige Dayton Smitten responds on our Facebook page. Have you tried a Thunder shirt? They work for lots of dogs. If you kennel Jackson at Mountain View Vets, that's in the Logan area, they will try the Thunder shirt there to see if it helps, so you don't need to buy one and have it not work. That's on the actual highlights selection from Utah Public Radio Facebook page. I'm clicking on now to sort by posts by others, which is what you need to do to see most of these posts. And now Shelley Wiegand-Kotinek. I hope you're pronouncing your name right. This is a beautiful dog. Annie is all about having fun. She is a great mountain biking and skiing partner. She is always game to go out and explore the mountains. She will even help catch a grouse or two for dinner. She also snores like no other after a big day. Wonderful. Rachel Ann Semft says, this is Nuala, a.k.a. Nuala Bula Bula Nuala Badger, Ruler Buller. She's the very best hiking, snowshoeing, cycling, swimming, camping, and everything in between companion. I adopted her when she was about 2 months old. She's now 2.5 years old and has helped me through so many struggles and always brings a smile to my face. She's sweet as can be, incredibly playful, and I'm a firm believer that everyone thing is her best friend, even cats who want nothing to do with her. Can't imagine life without this wonderful creature. Beautiful picture of that dog. Then from Sam Crump. And by the way, this picture, you have to click on the actual picture to see all of it, or you just see blue sky. He says, Aspen, just a dang good 40-pound brown dog from Alabama. And finally, this one in from Kelly Cop, or Kelly Cope. This is my dog, Abe. He's a fabulous dog and a great companion. I do have a behavior question, though. There's a large mastiff in the yard behind us, and he and Abe try to fight across the fence. If I put up a visual barrier, do you think it will help? We'll try to get that question over to our animal behavior specialist. So those are some messages about your pets. Keep them coming. Post them on the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Now on to Sherry Quinn in Access Utah.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn.
Melanoma is a serious public health problem.
That is Dr. Allie Grossman. She says melanoma is the most dangerous type of skin cancer. And according to the National Institutes of Health, it is the leading cause of death from skin disease. It usually starts as a single skin tumor, but cancer cells can spread or metastasize to sites throughout the body. Most commonly, it spreads to the liver, the lungs, bones, and brain. How melanoma spreads is a puzzle scientists are still trying to solve. Today on the program, Dr. Allie Grossman joins us to talk about new research that offers clues.
I am a pathologist at the University of Utah and ARUP Laboratory in the Department of Pathology, and I do research in the molecular medicine program.
Grossman moved to Utah in 2007 to complete medical residency training in anatomic pathology and stayed here for a postdoctoral position at the laboratory of Dr. Dean Lee in the molecular medicine program at the University of Utah.
And I'm currently finishing up one last clinical year doing molecular genetic pathology fellowship at ARUP.
What inspired you to pursue a career in medicine and particularly pathology?
I think I was inspired to pursue a career in medicine in college just from studying human biology. And I had always thought I was going to be actually a large animal veterinarian. And then in college, I was seduced, so to speak, into human biology. Found it quite fascinating, particularly genetics and molecular biology. That's probably also where my interest in cancer biology first arose. And then after college, I worked as a research assistant in the laboratory of Mike Liskay at Oregon Health Sciences University, in a laboratory that studied hereditary colon cancer. That was a very enriching experience in understanding molecular biology and genetics and how that relates to human disease and cancer. And then I went to medical school and also graduate school in the MD-PhD program at Oregon Health Sciences University. And in graduate school, I studied cancer again. I studied specific proteins that drive cancer called tyrosine kinases. I was in the laboratory of Brian Druker at Oregon Health Sciences University, and he was very inspiring, and the work that they were doing was very inspiring. Dr. Druker is well known for the development of the targeted therapy called Gleevec for chronic myelogenous leukemia and for gastrointestinal stromal tumors. And he really worked closely with Ciba Geigy, which then was bought out by Novartis, to develop really our first breakthrough molecularly targeted therapy for treating cancer. And that drug has performed very well and is really the model for molecularly targeted therapy in cancer. So I had a couple of really inspiring experiences in cancer research labs in Oregon.
In medical school in Oregon, her interest in the molecular genetics of cancer and in developing targeted therapies continued to grow.
I took every possible cancer-related rotation I could when I was in medical school, whether it was a surgery rotation or a medical oncology rotation or any of the other fields, obstetrics and gynecology. Just at every juncture and every rotation, I learned as much about the clinical aspects of cancer as possible, and really fell in love with pathology because I'm a very visual learner. And under the microscope, I like looking at tumors, basically, because I can learn a lot about how they grow and how they spread. You see not only the tumor spreading, but you see the body's response to that. You can see the body try to wall off that invasive process with scar tissue. And so you see the immune system. You see inflammatory cells coming in to try to fight those tumor cells. There's a variety of things we see under the microscope.
Melanoma is the sixth most common cancer in the United States. Approximately 1 in 50 people will develop it in their lifetime, and the number of melanoma cases diagnosed each year is increasing faster than for any other type of cancer. Dr. Grossman says the key to treating melanoma is to catch it early.
But the problem is catching it early is very difficult because it metastasizes. So once a melanoma reaches about 1 millimeter in the skin,
that is roughly only the size of the tip of a fine point Sharpie marking pen.
It gains access to the lymphatic system very rapidly and metastasizes. So as a pathologist, my job, if I'm looking at a skin specimen with melanoma in it, is to actually measure the depth of the tumor because that changes prognosis for the patient and it changes clinical management.
Dr. Grossman is making headway in her quest to help improve our understanding of the cellular machinery responsible for melanoma metastasis, with the goal of identifying therapies that may stop the spread of cancer cells. So far in her collaborative work, Dr. Grossman and a team of researchers have identified a critical protein role in the metastasis of melanoma. Inhibition of the protein, referred to as ARF6 for short, reduces the spread of melanoma to the lungs in mice, according to a study published in the March 5th issue of Science Signaling Online. The inference is that targeting ARF6 may be an effective approach to preventing melanoma metastasis. Dr. Grossman explains how this study got its start and the details of their findings.
So the first thing I did when I started residency here was actually try to find a mentor who could help me study cancer metastasis. That was my number one research agenda when I came as a resident, was to find a lab where I could study metastasis and hopefully try to figure out how to prevent metastasis. And I had heard a dean give a talk about our blood vessels and how they can be leaky in different inflammatory disease settings. And it occurred to me that, you know, what a great opportunity to study metastasis in a laboratory where the scientists are experts in what controls our blood vessels, because that's really how cancer cells spread, is they get into the lymphatics and the blood vessels and to travel to distant organs. And so I took a chance and went to a laboratory that was quite successful from a researcher's perspective, but had not attempted very much to venture into cancer biology. And it turned out to be a great partnership with a lot of expertise in the lab that I could then learn from myself and use the expertise there to really make progress in cancer model systems. And, you know, doing science is like raising children. It requires a village, as some famous person, Hillary Clinton, has said before. It takes a team of people and a lot of work from people with different expertise. So I put myself in that position to be surrounded by very accomplished, very hardworking, and generous scientists. And so there was really a group of us. And then we have investigators at Notre Dame who also made pretty significant contributions. But basically, what we have uncovered is the machinery that a tumor cell can use to become mobile, to disconnect from the attachments where it's anchored down in the tissue where it arose from, to pull up those anchors and disconnect and start moving and gaining access to local tissue invasion, but then also into the blood vessels to spread.
By closely studying the aggressive cancer cell machinery, they were able to figure out the specific protein responsible for the cascade of cellular events that lead to metastasis.
They secrete a protein called WNT5A, and it has been reported in the literature before that this protein is pertinent to disease progression in melanoma. So in patient samples, it has been shown that melanomas that produce this protein tend to be more metastatic. They progress more rapidly in patients and lead to worse outcomes. So we found that when we were working with human melanoma cell lines, that some of these cell lines expressed abundant amounts. They produced a lot of this WNT5A protein. And that was the initiating signal that activated in a stepwise manner a number of downstream events that ultimately led to tumor cell motility and metastasis. So we were able to come in and tease apart some of the key elements downstream, the key protein, the machinery downstream of WNT5A signaling, and specifically a protein called ARF6. It's a very small protein within a cell, and it orchestrates a number of events. It actually can integrate pro-migratory signals from proteins called WNT5A, but also it can respond to inhibitory signals from a protein and ligand and receptor complex called SLIT and ROBO. And so it really is like this integrative switch. It can be turned on or off to make a cell mobile. And that's an advantage for a cancer cell because it allows a cancer cell, when it needs to move to a more growth-promoting environment where there's more nutrients, it can move. Then when it's found a sort of a nutrient-rich environment, it can now stop migrating and start carrying on other cellular functions like proliferation. So cells need to have very dynamic control over movement, cancer cells, to be able to survive and to grow. And so this protein, ARF6, allows that. But the initiating signal comes from proteins like WNT5A, and that was part of our discovery, that WNT5A activates ARF6 to get melanoma cells to migrate and invade and metastasize. And the other key thing of this study was we were able to target this small protein, ARF6, with a small molecule inhibitor called Secin-H3. And when we did this in mice, we actually dramatically significantly slowed down metastasis. We had less mice with spontaneous melanoma metastasis, and within the mice that had metastasis, there were less metastatic foci.
How would you apply this to humans, and how far down the road?
This is preliminary preclinical data. This is a brand new pathway that's been described. And so what we need to do is see how prevalent this pathway is. ARF6 is a protein that is expressed in all cell types, but we need to see how relevant is this in really a population of patient samples and use the tools that we have to see whether this is really as common a pathway as we think it is. And then we need to develop better inhibitors. The small molecule inhibitor we used is really not amenable for patient care.
Dr. Grossman and Dean Lee's lab at the U of U are collaborating with a local pharmaceutical company called Navigen to develop better ARF6 inhibitors, and they will be testing them in various cancer models. She is excited about the research for several reasons.
First and foremost, our findings in melanoma are likely to also be applicable in other cancer types. So cancer cells from different origins have a tendency to really exploit the same pathways in slightly different ways. So we think that ARF6 likely controls tumor cell motility, invasion, and metastasis in multiple cancer cell types, and we'll be exploring that. So it's exciting for cancer research in general when a new pathway is discovered, especially when it's potentially targetable. It's also exciting because in melanoma specifically, melanoma is an extremely aggressive cancer, and there have been some very exciting discoveries advancements in the treatment for metastatic melanoma, and there's been rapid progress in the last few years in advancement of treatment for melanoma. But the treatments that we have try to kill the existing tumors by inhibiting their growth or getting the immune system to attack those tumors. But unfortunately, while we get a nice response in these patients, it's usually not durable. It's really almost, it's very rare that we get long-term survivorship with the current systemic treatment for advanced stage melanoma. Very, very small percentage of those patients will actually have long-term survivorship. And so what is lethal to these patients is disease progression when their melanoma, which is already maybe in advanced stage, but it continues to spread to vital organs such as the brain and the lungs and the liver. That is what ends up being lethal to patients. And so we know a lot about how to kill the growth of tumors, but we don't know how to stop their spread. This is a pathway where we can potentially, you know, combine treatment with agents that target tumor cell growth with anti-metastatic agents and have two different mechanisms to treat patients with advanced stage disease.
Do you know why certain types of cancers, particularly melanoma, will tend to spread to certain parts of the body?
That's a very broad base of investigation by a number of scientists really around the world. And there's a number of hypotheses out there as to why certain cancers are drawn to certain organs. The lungs are thought to be a common site of metastasis because it's very vascular and rich in small capillaries. So it's thought that, you know, tumor cells, once they get into the bloodstream, the first place they go is to the heart and lungs. And then that's a very oxygen-rich, nutrient-rich environment where tumor cells can set up shop and start growing. You know, once tumor cells make it into the bloodstream, all the blood is carried eventually back to the heart and the lungs. So the lungs are also, they have a lot of tiny little capillaries, so tumor cells get stuck in those tiny little capillaries. But, you know, that's only probably part of the answer to the question. And what you're asking is something that we don't know all the answers to yet. Melanoma is a little bit unique. It certainly has a predilection for liver and lung and brain. However, melanoma is often called the great masquerader. More so than many other cancers, it has the capacity to really metastasize earlier in disease and also to more sites. It's really one of the most aggressive cancers out there.
That was Dr. Allie Grossman. To learn more about melanoma, she recommends searching these websites.
There's information about melanoma at the website for the National Cancer Institute. There's information about melanoma and screening programs and melanoma treatment at Huntsman Cancer Institute websites. And I would refer patients to those websites for information and just encourage everyone to go get a skin check and wear lots of sunblock.
Thank you for listening. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah.
Firefly burning bright.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery.
That is author Temple Grandin, referring to the science fiction novel Dune by Frank Herbert, later turned into a Hollywood movie. The story is set far into the future and takes place on the desert planet Arrakis, the only source of the most valuable spice or substance in the universe, melange.
The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
You are about to enter a world where the unexpected Many dangers exist on Arrakis.
The unknown and an incredible secret have been kept on this planet. And the unbelievable meet.
According to Grandin, this tale about the battle over Melange and the direction it takes human civilization mirrors reality. And now the spice is natural gas. U.S. House lawmakers from the Subcommittee on Energy and Mineral Resources met in Steubenville, Ohio in March for a hearing on natural gas. Congressman Doug Lamborn has dollar signs in his eyes.
The natural gas industry has the potential to bring in billions of dollars of federal revenue, bring energy to our national economy, create good-paying jobs for thousands of Americans, and most importantly, greatly contribute to the economies of the towns and cities that benefit from this development.
And the areas being targeted for this unconventional natural gas extraction sit atop a unique geographical feature.
The United States is blessed with some of the richest and largest natural gas shale fields in the world. The Marcellus Shale, Barnett Shale, the Bakken Formation are all previously unproductive areas that have just recently become extraordinarily productive gas and oil fields because of hydraulic fracturing.
Natural gas from shale provided only 1% of the nation's gas supplies in 2000. Now it is 25%, the beginning of a new era. The increase is due to hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking. It involves drilling deep, about 6,000 feet below the ground surface, and then horizontally in any direction, causing a web of fractures that releases millions of years-old reserves of natural gas, shaking up this till now untouched antediluvian underground and siphoning out its contents. Is releasing deep concerns.
Call 911, where's your emergency?
Hey, my house just shook really bad.
Yes, it probably was an earthquake.
You can hear it coming towards you kind of like you would a train. You feel it under your feet.
It shook our whole house about off the foundation, ma'am.
Good evening. Since September, there have been 843 earthquakes in the Greenbrier Guy Swarm. This fault was previously...
Today on the program, we travel to two of the nation's fracking hubs, southeastern Ohio and the Uinta Basin area of eastern Utah, where oil and gas companies are breaking into deep pockets of the earth, forcing us to ask, is the easy money and fuel worth all the risk? Risks like polluted drinking water, toxic air, dangerous chemical spills, loud obnoxious noises, earthquakes, heavy traffic, sick animals, loss of habitat, and loss of prime farmland. Our first stop in this story is Ohio. Proudly surrounded by his pack of black labs, Mick Luber, known as the Renaissance Farmer, answers our question with a resounding no. Fracking is definitely not worth it.
This is Katie 2. There was a Katie 1 and a big Katie before them. This is Lucinda, and that's Sylvester. They're the rodent control. They're working dogs, and they do a good job.
Then there's Nancy Sinatra, the cat with the white boots, and Goldie, named after the movie star.
The chickens are the manure source for everything. We do compost. We do about 3 tons of compost a year. And that's the fertility for these beds.
Mick is a certified organic farmer. His 61-acre farm in Cadiz, Ohio, sits close to the border of West Virginia, nestled in a small, lush green valley surrounded by rolling forested hills. He specializes in garlic and lettuce, and grows fruit, herbs, mushrooms, flowers, raises chickens for eggs, and has row upon row of lettuce in a prism of red and yellow shades. All kinds of beans.
Green, yellow, striped, speckled beans. I cook a lot, so I grow what I like to cook, and it makes it really nice for customers at the markets because they can find out little tips about what they can eat for dinner the next night. I grow 12 kinds of onions. It's just nice, all the varieties. It changes every day. It's so creative. I have lettuce patches like that run as long as this bed here, which is about 200 feet long. And there's 30 different kinds of lettuce in it. And it's like a painting. It's just beautiful.
Mick established his farm in 1989, one of the longest continually certified organic farms in the state of Ohio. The inspiration for organic farming started when he was a young boy in Chicago, frequenting the local supermarket with his father.
You just go to a Jewel Tea store to get fresh produce. Produce manager's hands were always cracked and bleeding. I became friends with him, asked him about his hands. He says, all the chemicals on this produce, I can't get my hands to heal. Doctors tell me I should be wearing gloves, but it wouldn't be good for customers to see somebody wearing gloves. This is in 1968 or 69.
But this move to organic wasn't a lasting escape. Mick fears that the pesticides that were cracking hands in the 60s are replaced by fracking chemicals, toxifying his air, water, and his soil too. Just like many rural towns across the nation, his community is surrounded by fracking sites. And in fact, his neighbor just up the hill from him leased his land to Chesapeake Oil and Gas, who last year installed a drip tank about the size of a one-car garage on his property to collect moisture from fracking wells.
We got into Mick's car and drove to it with artist Zach Pontius and farmer Sherry Becker Gorby. All of them are from communities that live atop the shale.
And this is my neighbor, the Cave. He came over and talked to me one day. I was turning the compost pile, and he was all against it and everything like that. And then I called my neighbor, and I found out that he had caved. Just to the intimidation, he didn't really have to let him in there. The neighbor up on the hill let him put in the drip. If they hadn't talked like they were against it, I don't think I would have got as mad. And here's the tank. You can pull over there on that side of the road. You can see the drip. And we can get out. And they might have a camera here, so you can wave. Do you see that door up there that's open? According to things that I've seen, if you had an infrared thing, you could see stuff coming out of there. And that's volatile chemicals that can float down that valley, and we're going to have to breathe it.
Roughly half the fracking fluid remains in the ground. The rest of it, 1 million to 4 million gallons, comes up out of the well and is toxic industrial waste. But is it being disposed of safely? That is a major concern currently under scrutiny by concerned citizens, scientists, and a myriad of organizations, including the EPA.
John Stoltz. I'm a professor of biology in the Department of Biological Sciences at Duquesne University. Unfortunately, once you contaminate an aquifer, it takes centuries. And that's something I learned from the DOE. Seeing all the work that's been done to remediate Superfund sites, realizing how difficult it is to clean something up once it's contaminated. In some cases, they've removed all the surface contamination and replaced it with pristine topsoil. And yet, contaminants continue to leach out of the subsurface, and they're beside themselves to try and do something about it.
Back at the farm, Mick sits in the shadow of a giant holding tank, casting a constant reminder, even an omen, of what is about to be unleashed.
At nights, the airflow comes over top of the hill. If there's chemicals venting out of that tank, it's going to come down that valley and run right past this house. Nice blue tank. Isn't that nice? Just like the sky. It's a rented tank, so somebody else is responsible for taking it out and putting it in. And I'm afraid whoever does it is going to spill stuff. That also comes down and runs through this valley. The stream here floods a couple times a year in a wet year. Last year, ran over these fields two times. I'll lose my certification if that happens.
The actual drilling site where they're extracting the gas is located about half a mile up the road from the blue tank. It looked like a small industrial village equipped with large cement enclosures, spotlights, semi-trucks, and networks of pipe that are lining the hillsides like arteries and veins, transferring the fracking fluids and gas to and fro. A big operation.
And how concerned are you about your land and the future of it?
Well, it's scary. My water here has already been ruined by coal mines. There's iron oxide in the water, and I don't need more chemicals in order to make me grow.
Hydrofracking is booming since Halliburton's horizontal drilling technology allowed its arms to reach a mile radius in any direction, pumping water and binding chemicals into the deep pockets of the Marcellus Shale. The pockets of the oil and gas companies are comparatively deep, We heard this along the way. Horizontal drilling makes for vertical profits. And we're talking multi-billion dollar vertical profits, stepping on shoulders to fatten the stack.
We've lost so much in this area. We've been a national sacrifice area for the steel and coal industry. And here comes another. There's not a big population in this area, so it's easy to bring a little bit of cash in, buy people's loyalty.
Most of us know what it feels like not to get along with a neighbor. And really, no kind of fence can stop this one. In a culture where each keeps to his or her own and choice is free, fracking is changing this culture. Mick's neighbor made an independent choice for his own reasons, but this choice is now governing Mick's organic future.
This is like the split the neighborhood thing. I have not sold my gas. I don't plan on selling my gas. They did sell their gas. I've known these people for 28 years. I've done their gardens for them. The guy that moved up on the hill, I took my tractor, tilled his garden when he first moved in so he could have a garden. I have not spoken to them since it happened. It's not easy.
Right.
To lose your neighbors to something. And those gas people will leave here and they'll still be my neighbors. And there's this animosity now. I'm sure that they would forgive me for not talking to them, but and those gas people will leave here and they'll still be my neighbors. And there's this animosity now. I'm sure that they would forgive me for not talking to them, but and the industrial process that they're talking about with this fracking, I mean, it's like putting a steel mill or a coal dock on the top of these hills. And to think that something like that is going to happen here again, it makes me glad that I'm old and that I don't have to watch it all over again and drink the water and go through all that stuff. When you go into the stores around here now, most people come in and they're buying bottled water. And I'm afraid with the advent of this gas and oil shale stuff that they're going to have to be buying water to bathe in, not just water to drink.
For these reasons, Luber won't lease. He won't even budge. And he certainly isn't seduced by the young, well-dressed, handsome men that come by the house.
They always send in these cute little boys with suits and ties and a little briefcase, look like they got out of college, to tell you that everything was going to be all right if they were doing some sort of project in your area. And that's exactly what these people look like. They look like somebody you would trust. But when you really get down to the nitty-gritty, you can't trust anybody. They call all the time. They offered me $350,000 the other day for 60 acres, so that's $5,500 or something like that an acre. No, that's just a sign, an agreement so that they can, and it's 15.5% royalty on if they do drill. But I'm not signing.
You can't help but wonder, if everyone was selling around you, wouldn't you cave too?
How do you stop these guys? It's like impossible. If you sold your place, where aren't they going to be next?
And how long do you expect this to last?
Well, they're talking about this being around forever. I mean, if you look out west at the sites that they have out west, it doesn't look like they're stopping. And they're going to frack these things two or three times. If the normal life expectancy is 3 years on these wells, and then they frack them again and frack them again and frack them again, so they could be here for 25, 30 years. And who knows how long.
What's happening in Mick Luber's moist green environment is also happening in a totally different ecosystem, nearly 2,000 miles away, in the high desert of northeastern Utah. It is part of the Colorado Plateau, and it's called the Uinta Basin. Here, the summers are hot and dry, and the winters hover at 0 degrees. driving into the area's famous prehistoric rock art gallery, Nine Mile Canyon. The surrounding views are vast fields of beige-colored granite, speckled with light green sagebrush, bordered with striking mustard and rusty red-colored cliffs, topped with cedar and juniper trees. Below, the river valley is filled with aspen, scrub oak, and pine. We are with well-known and respected local Floyd Cox. He comes from a long line of ranchers in the region. It used to be strictly cowboy and Indian country. But since the 1980s, he has seen the oil companies move in, and now ranchers and drill sites sit side by side.
Boy, this is a nice road. Look at all them pipelines out there. They're all over. Yeah, you go out in the desert now and all you see is oil wells.
What do you think about that?
Well, you can't stop progress. That's a necessity. And it gives everybody jobs. And this place does have a lot of jobs. A lot of jobs out here. A lot of work.
He has seen the counties of Carbon, Duchesne, and Uinta boom and bust since the 1940s due to fluctuations in the oil and gas industry. Right now, it is flourishing with jobs and growth alongside the ranchers and farmers. Conventional oil fields in the Uinta Basin provide 67% of Utah's total crude oil production, while the basin's unconventional natural gas fields provide 71% of Utah's total natural gas, a whopping 175% increase in the last 10 years. Veteran oil and gas industry worker and farmer, Steve, who is going by that name to remain anonymous, knows both industries inside and out. He says that comes with growing up in the Uinta Basin. Work is oil-related, and on your days off, you farm. It's just a different world, he says. Steve and his cousin and I recently shared a cup of coffee and some fracking conversation at his home he shares with his wife, two boys, three dogs, two cats, and a team of horses in his fields out back.
What it comes down to is keeping up with the Joneses or staying ahead of the Joneses. Somebody's worried somebody else is going to get somebody something that nobody else got. It's just like, no.
In the nearby town of Mighton, Steve says one of his fellow farmers has learned to take advantage of his neighbor's mistakes.
Every twice in a while, they dump a crude truck right there. Off the road, tip it over, make
You're
a mess.
Kidding.
You know what he does? He runs out there with his tractor and spreads that oil around. All over his pasture.
Was that good for it?
That's one of the best fertilizers because it's all natural.
At times, when utilized properly and safely, farmers can benefit from the oil spills. But that is the exception. Steve says agriculture is the biggest and fastest depleting resource on the planet.
And the biggest reason is big corporations, and especially this area, is the oil and gas industry. Because they will go in and take that strip of road out of your field. And they will put that location right in the center of it. And let's say that they take 7 acres, and if it's good farmable ground, you're looking at three mother cows. Could live on that. If it's hay, and let's say it's a good hay field, and it's producing a whole bunch, well, on them 7 acres, let's say that in the end you're getting really, really good, decent ground, 3 ton to the acre. Okay, well, ton of hay is how much?
Good alfalfa hay is selling for $200 to $260 a ton based on the current market. And it goes up every year. The same with beef. Right now, Steve says he can get $1,300 a pair. That's a mother cow and her calf. It begs the question, what is more valuable? Hay for feed, or natural gas for cheap fuel. To a farmer, hay can be worth more than gold. But if the farmer only owns the surface rights to his or her property and not the mineral rights, the oil and gas companies can move in and reap the resource, leaving the farmer out of luck.
The law says the minerals are there and they can go get them. Human nature is also leans toward the side of always a quick buck, not what's right or wrong.
Although the companies usually offer compensation, it is never enough, even when farmers own the mineral rights and decide to lease anyway.
We're going to put this location here, and all these empty promises, this is going to be a good, beautiful thing, and we're going to pay you $9,000 for nothing, for tearing up your ground, a one-time shot deal. We're going to use 1/8 of an acre of your ground right on the corner, cutting into that sagebrush right there. But then we're going to directional drill that out to the middle of your field. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to farm around this 1/8 of an acre corner right here, which probably your sprinklers and stuff don't hit anyway. That's the most justifiable we can do. We'll give you $9,000 for that 1/8 of an acre, and we'll give you $9,000 for the whole mess we're going to put out in the middle of your field.
That's it, really? I
mean, that's what it boils down to. It is that freaking simple.
The Ute Indian Reservation in the Uinta Basin is the second largest reservation in the United States, and they're leasing chunks of their land to the oil and gas companies for more money than what the farmers outside of the reservation are getting. The long-term economic impact to the farmers and the Utes will add up. As prices of hay and beef rise each year, the cumulative effect of the loss of land will catch up to them years later in monetary losses, and the oil and gas companies do not account for that. They also don't take responsibility or liability for any leftover messes. Instead, the landowner is left to deal with them.
Leaves the mineral rights holders, leaves them responsible also for spills, contamination, blah, blah, blah. And the oil company sitting back there raking in big bucks and leaving the liability to so-and-so. And for as long as they want to produce that location, produce that well, produce that lease, they're probably going to take care of business and step up to bat. But in them contracts, it does not say that they cannot walk away and leave you totally liable. It says just the other way. If it gets bad enough, we're going to throw our hands in the air. You're going to be responsible for whatever mess we leave. We're out of here. So that's why I say, who's right and who's wrong?
Yeah.
The guy says, come in, and come on, give me that $9,000 and put all that liability on me. When in return, it should be no. And that's the thing, you cannot deny them.
Why?
But the law says you
can't. Just because the law, yeah.
But you can say, well, all right, you want to build this location? Sooner or later, that well's going to, it's going to peter off and not be justifiable for anybody to do anything with it. You can't do away with petroleum energy. We're too dependent on it. There's some good guys, and a lot of them just have no idea what they're doing, and they're too afraid to get fired to tell their boss, no, this is morally wrong. We ain't going to drive out in the middle of this field and say, no, they should approach with a plan and go do environmental impact reports and cost reports and just little spreadsheets that says, you know, approach the farmer and say, you know, we would like to poke the hole right out in the middle of your 80 acres, but we're going to destroy about 7 acres getting there because of our road, because of where we're going to put the location. You're going to have to farm around it. Most of these peoples are their neighbors, or one of their nephews works for that oil company. This is a clannish bunch of people up here.
To really keep track of their impact on the land, Steve sees the need for companies to self-regulate much more so than they did in the past.
Everything that's going to be done on these, you can look up in archive after archive. There's no soil samples from 1980. What has the ground done? What did it look like? Unless you know somebody with pictures, it's all word of mouth. The law is what the law is, whatever. They should have to do their freaking environmental impact reports. They should, start to finish.
One of the side effects of fast, poorly regulated oil and gas drilling activity is what's referred to as poison gas.
They inject the water into the formation, pushes the oil out toward the oil wells. Some of the water comes up too, yes. But now that water's contaminated because oil and water don't mix.
The result is H2S, hydrogen sulfide, a toxic gas that smells like rotten eggs.
They say like the dust you see in the window pane when the sun's shining through. That'll be like one part per every 10 million. And you can see it. If you took a whiff of, I believe it's 10 parts per million of hydrogen sulfide, you're dead. Like that fast. But here lies another problem, like with what Newfield and a lot of other outfits, I'm just not picking on them, do. They sit and they inject into the ground. Have you ever put a bucket of water outside? It goes stagnant, right? It starts to stink. That's H2S. That's decaying matter. There's little bugs that's in the water, little bugs that float across the air. They're in the air anyway, get into the water, and it sits there and it starts to decay. And even if you put it in a bowl or a cup or a jug and you cap it and you set it outside, mm-hmm. you're going to want to drink it in a month.
The oil and gas companies are using filters, cloth ones developed in the 1970s.
They're filtering out chunks of slag and just anything that is going to screw with their wellbore. They're not filtering out these little microscopic organisms and stuff in the water. You're agitating it again when it comes back to surface, gets a breath of fresh air. You suck it into a water truck, you agitate it in the water truck, so now you got it really stirred up and you take it somewhere and you eject it again. Look up the Jonah Field over in Wyoming. Look up the field that's right there, this side of Echo. They've not been doing business according to, look what we're doing.
Those of us living near oil refineries, oil and gas fields, and factory farms' huge sewage lagoons risk long-term exposure to H2S, causing permanent nervous and respiratory system damage, and in some cases, death. It has not affected the Uinta Basin too much yet, but the problem there is starting to get worse. Although hydrogen sulfide sources are supposed to report their emissions to the EPA, the agency has allowed these polluters to avoid reporting their pollution for nearly two decades. The farmers in southeastern Ohio and in northeastern Utah are all deeply rooted to the land, each of them going back generations as either steelworkers, coal miners, oil workers, or farmers and ranchers. Talking to Mick Luber is holding up a mirror to what is happening out west. Only the background scenery is different.
Everybody wants to be a millionaire. But I'm a millionaire in soil and worms and that kind of stuff.
The drip tank was recently removed from his neighbor's property, but Mick said there was some spillage, and another one is going in nearby. The pipeline right-of-way is still happening heavily in his area, and Mick Luber is still constantly approached, but he always refuses.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Zizi Montgomery, and intern Elaine Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And we do appreciate your listening. Just wanted to come in here at the end of the program, Tom Williams with you, tell you about Monday's program, and we'd like your help with the program. We're going to be asking you what's on your book list. What are you reading as we head into summer? We'll have some booksellers with us to tell us what's the latest and greatest and what's upcoming. But mostly, we'll turn to you and ask you what you're reading, what you can suggest to us to put on our book lists. This could be something you're reading now, something in the past that has had a special impact on you, or something you're looking forward to reading. And we'll pool our resources and really get some good book lists going that we can work on through the summer. So it's What Are You Reading is the title of the show, and we're encouraging you to either email us your book list. Tell us, of course, the title, the author, and a brief message about why you love this book or looking forward to it. And you can do that at upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. Or you can go to our Facebook page, Utah Public Radio Facebook page, and post your list there, perhaps even with a book cover of one of your favorite books. We'll be looking for those. We'll be getting those on the air. And, of course, call us on the day of the program, 9 to 10 Monday morning at 1-800-826-1495. We're looking for your book list, your suggestions for either children's, young adult, or adult. Could be fiction or nonfiction. Anything that you have on your book list or looking forward to or especially has impacted you in the past, and that will help out your fellow listeners with their book list. Book program on Monday. We'd love to see your list either at upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com, or on our Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Thanks for listening today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.